Well, we are going to do this week what I told you last week, and we're going over exactly the same text that we did last week, Hebrews chapter 5, 12 through 15. I can probably assure most of you, and if you've been with us on a regular basis, you'll know that it probably won't be a carbon copy of last week's message. There is a rich depth of information and truth that spills out of this particular text, and I want us to take at least a little bit more of a time to understand some of the implications for our own life. I don't know if any of you saw the movie. Some of you, back in 2013, they produced a movie called The Lone Ranger. It is an offshoot of a movie, actually a radio series way back in the 1940s called The Lone Ranger, where a particular lone individual, a ranger, at that time his name was Jack Carlton Moore, who played the role of the Lone Ranger. They actually found a Canadian native to play the role of Tonto back then, and they produced black and white movies. And what was remarkable is this person, this Clayton Moore, he was actually a model, and he was in Hollywood trying to get modeling access, had a couple of small bits in some movies and some westerns, and happened to be the choice that the writers and producers of The Lone Ranger picked him to take this role. And the movie actually, back in about 1950, got an Emmy nomination at the Emmy Awards. I don't believe it won at that particular time, but it was probably the highest ranking show. I think it was NBC that produced it at that particular time. And so he was kind of on the height of this as he was going through this movie production. And Clayton Moore was the hero of this thing for the first 2 years. And then all of a sudden, just like that, the producers kicked him out of the show. He was gone after two seasons. And they brought in another actor, and he came in and filled the role. And then after a year, they completely flipped again, and they rehired Clayton Moore to finish off the series. And it went for two more years and finished off five seasons, and it was kind of the show to watch. I remember when I was a kid seeing The Lone Ranger, you know, running around, him and Tonto beating up the bad guys and fighting greed and corruption and everything else. But what had happened to him was really remarkable, because at one moment he was at the height of his career, stepping out and finding all kinds of new opportunities. And then just like that, for apparently very undisclosed reasons, he was out. He'd lost everything that he had gained and earned in that particular situation. You know, when we think of Romans, I want you to think of this whole journey talking about Adam being a type of Christ is really the same thing. God had created Adam and Eve and put them in a perfect environment, and yet he gave them the opportunity to follow God out of a sense of choice and love for him, and they lost it all. From our vantage point, it looks like for the dumbest reasons, they decided that they were going to take matters into their own hands, and they lost paradise. And they sort of threw it away and got exiled from the garden to never reclaim it based on their own merits. And yet the whole story of the gospel is that that can be reclaimed through the person of Christ. And this morning, I don't know what your journey is in life, but there are lots of us who feel like, even in the practical realities of life, that we've lost things, that we've regretted certain decisions that we've made. We've made mistakes, or things have happened to us where we felt like the end of the world was coming because we've lost something that was precious to us. Now, from God's perspective, we've all lost something. We have been infected, as it were, by the problem of sin and death, and we have lost more than most of us even realize. And when we come to Romans chapter 5, he sort of paints this picture for us, and I want to walk through it this morning to help us get a little bit of an idea of the sense of what that loss was, which is indicated in the title, from the grave to the gift. Because we find ourselves in a predicament that we can't solve ourselves, and yet the gift of Christ can reverse everything that we've lost in terms of what Adam's done. So I want to begin by looking at some of these verses we looked at last week. If you're visiting with us, as I said, we're in Romans chapter 5. We want to read through verses 12 through 15. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was not in the world before the law was given, but sin was not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those sinning, whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who is to come. But the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift by that grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abound to many. Now, some of that may just be like garbledygook to some of you. You kind of read it through and it says, well, it sounds like a lot of technical things that we've sinned and that somebody sinned without the law and then they all died and what's the point? So let me just kind of remind you of what we've lost. Because what happened with Adam is that he sort of catapulted us into a reign of sin and death. And that is pretty profound. The sin is any trespass, any error, any fault that we have made in terms of life. But it's not just the bad things that we might sort of consider doing. We've broken God's law even when you weren't aware of it. But we have violated relationships. We've violated moral codes and ethics. We violated all kinds of things in life, and we continue to do it. But on the other side, the word sin simply means to miss the mark. In fact, it doesn't matter how hard you try to do the right things, there's times that the standard is so high that it's impossible to be perfect. And yet that motivation drives a lot of even Christians, that the whole goal of life is to be better and better and faster and quicker than the people around us. I mean, you see it in our sports programs for sure, that those who get the scholarships, those who get the privileges are the ones who are the top 1 and 2%. You went through the NFL draft this weekend and you're a football nut, you'll know that they're picking the top 1, 2% of all the players in football to join their teams to make them better. But in the heart of this thing, sin, Adam's sin, has created a catastrophe for us because he says, because of Adam's sin, everyone sinned. And we'll try to poke at that a little bit. But the other result is the issue of death. And the basic concept of death is the word separation. It's not the extinction of something, it's separation. And so there are three different labels of this idea of separation. There is the nature of it is first spiritual. We are separated away from God. So when Adam and Eve had this great privilege, let's call it family relationship with God, they basically wrecked that by their sin. They were exiled from the garden. God, you can see that God forgave them, but they lost the privilege of being in paradise. And their separation from God actually had to forge a new kind of relationship with him that wasn't what it was. And so the first idea is that there's spiritual separation. That touches every human being that's come into this world, that they have sinned and they are separated. If you go through Ephesians and Colossians, it tells us that we are without hope, without God in the world, that we're not accepted by him. When you die, you will not go to heaven. You don't go to a better place. That because of sin, we are separated and do not have the privileges of all that God offers to those who are part of his family. And so the first thing that we need to sort of get in our head is realize that we're sinners and we're separated in our relationship with God. It's fractured. But the other element is relational. It didn't take very long for Adam and Eve not only to try to find a hiding place from God, but then when they got caught, because that's what happens, we go and hide, and they got caught, what was the first thing that happened? Well, they started blaming each other. At least that was the lead move for Adam. The woman you gave to me, which is a really dangerous thing to sort of do a backhanded blaming God for this, risky. The woman you gave to me, she did it. So then God goes and talks to the woman, like, what's your deal? Well, it was that guy over there who convinced us that doing, she didn't put it this way, but following you wasn't a really good idea and we could do it better ourselves. So then God says, well, now there's a curse. There's consequences to rebelling against me. And so they have this separation in their own relationship. And it's the same kind of problem that's been separating marriages and families ever since, is this problem of sin. And so that becomes fractured, that becomes separated. And then the ultimate evidence, whether you would agree with those or not, is physical death. Physical death means that immaterial, invisible essence of what makes you an individual separates from our physical body and either goes to be in the presence of God or goes, as the scriptures would say, to Hades, being separated from God. Someone once described this departure as they were talking to people about, you know, well, they don't really believe in God and they don't think it's necessary and I don't need it. And yet then they'll complain that you're saying I don't get to go to a better place or heaven when I die. I think I've done a basically good job of life. Why do I need to do that? And someone responded by saying, well, listen, if you didn't want to have anything to do with God during your life, why should it be any different after you die? I mean, why would you want it to be different if you didn't want anything to do with God while you lived? What, he's just giving you your wish when you die. You get to be separated from him there. People say, well, I think that's unfair. Really? That's more like insanity. I mean, but anyway, we'll go. That's the problem. And so there's this spiritual separation from God. There's this separation in our relationships, so it's fractured and destroyed and messed up our lives. And then the ultimate evidence is physical death. And we, you and I both know, you talk to any sane person and knows that physical death is not something any of us can avoid or conquer. And so that becomes the reign of sin and death. We cannot escape it. It dominates our lives. We are not free from it at all. And so the idea of absolute freedom is not a reality in human relationships. And the problem that we're going to find is that we can't solve it on our own. And so as we begin to filter through this, this is the problem. This is the frustration. And then the question obviously raises, what's our relationship to Adam? Because he makes an interesting statement there. When you're looking at that particular verse, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For those of you that love language, that's an aorist tense verb, which means there's no time limit on it. It's just everybody gets lumped in together and all sin. Everybody's messed up. It's kind of like, we weren't even there. Why am I getting blamed? Well, that's a good question. There's two questions that really come up here. What's the nature of our relationship to Adam? How does sin and death get passed down to us? And the second question is, where do each of us come from? How do each of us get here as individuals to exist as a human being in the world that we are in? So let me try to remind you briefly that this sort of becomes the affliction. And yet the questions are very real because it doesn't give us a lot of detail about what that looks like. We are both victims of what's passed on. It's kind of like a toxic pathogen that gets passed on through humanity. And because Adam and Eve are sort of the progenitors of all humanity, they just pass it on to everybody else. But the second reality is that we also commit sin. I've had a few people that will make the argument that they think they're pretty good, but if I ask them if they're perfect, it's very hard for a person to get to the point where they can try to prove that they're perfect. I mean, it's really easy to disprove that. All you have to do is talk to a spouse, or you have to talk to the kids, or you talk to their best friend, and you can find out really quickly, no matter how delusional a person might be, that they're not perfect. And so that becomes the problem. Now, when it comes to our origins, how did you get here? How does that work? Well, there are several different theories, and I thought I would touch on them this morning because it's raised by this particular text, is that there's four or five theories about how we got here. The one is reincarnation. It's kind of an Indian, Middle East, Hindu, Buddhist kind of philosophy and religion. If you've come from that background, reincarnation is something that's fairly prevalent, and it's certainly prevalent. You'll run into it over here in our culture as well. But the Bible doesn't support the idea of reincarnation, that we die and then we come back and then we die and come back, and it's all based, whether it's on karma or other things. All I can tell you is the Bible doesn't support that. And so it's a difficult one for me to buy into because the Bible in no way, shape, or form encourages the idea of reincarnation. The second one is what Origen, and you, if you come from a Mormon background, this will sound more familiar, the pre-existence of the soul, that God has created all these souls, and he sort of has a collection of them up there, whether, you know, in some fashion, and that he just kind of keeps divvying them out as we go. And it's too complicated to get into it this morning, but that's one that I certainly understand the thought process behind it, because Colossians would say God's created everything already, whether visible or invisible. Anything that came into existence already has been created. And so it makes it easy jump to say, well, everybody who's ever going to exist has existed since God created them, and then how we get here is kind of how God is up to God. That one is a little trickier. We're not going to get into the details of it this morning. But the third one is creationism. Now, that's a term that we often use of Genesis 1. By the way, I want to reiterate what Grant said. If you really have a heart to just go deeper in your walk with God and understand what it means to be a disciple of Christ, I think these Groveview classes are fabulous. If you've got a heart to learn that at all, they'll be terrific. So, and if you're new to our church and want to know anything about what we're doing, our purpose, our vision, come and join us at Get to Know Oak Grove, and that'll give you some insights that'll be invaluable in knowing how you would fit here. But the idea of this comes back to the idea is that God creates a body, a mom and dad, as it were, would create a physical body, and then creationism is God would create a soul to fit into that. And he sort of does it on an ongoing basis, which is a really trickier one for us to understand in terms of that process. So let me flip forward here. I gave a couple of them, but this is the God just inserts them as they're born. Now, that's an interesting philosophical point, but not one that's often common held. There's a lot of the distinction between the invisible person that I am in here and our physical body, and that's kind of the support that it has, is that these are really distinct things. In our culture, most people view their sense of identity by their physical body. What I see in the mirror is my sense of value and purpose. And that is certainly part of who I am, but it often ignores the reality that I'm created in the image of God. And that what's most important is that individual essence of who we are internally as it's expressed in the way we live life. The third one is what we call federal headship. And this means that Adam was a universal representative. I don't know if you remember the story of David and Goliath, but instead of having these two armies come out and beat each other to a pulp and have all kinds of mess going on, armies would often pick a champion. And so Goliath was the champion for the other guys, and David was the champion that went out. And whoever won, the other would just surrender everything. Rather than going through the bloody horrors of war, they would just surrender, and they would yield to the authority and to the kingship of the other country or the nation, whatever it was. And so a lot of people, this whole passage, as we go through it, Romans 5, 12 through about 20, really talks about this federal headship thing, that Adam was a representative. He made a choice as our human representative, even though he didn't exist. We were culpable and found guilty because of his choice, and that becomes the process. On the flip side, it's going to say, well, Christ becomes the head, the federal representative of anyone who puts faith and trust in him. We get his righteousness, and that's accounted to us. And so that's the argument that works through here. And so that's another way of thinking about how we are affected by Adam, how our the nature of our relationship, and what that looks like. The other one, and I don't expect you to memorize this, is called traducianism. You don't have to remember the term, but the basic premise is that mom and dad pass on not just a body, but they pass on the soul as well. That they have the power, because of the way God has created to us, through the reproductive elements of things, to pass on not just a physical body, but a person's essence is passed on there as well. Now, you might say, where in the world do we get that? Well, let me show you one verse that would seem to indicate this. If you go into Genesis 5, you'll notice that it says, in the book of generation of Adam, in the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created the male and female. But then in Genesis, a couple of verses later, when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and his name was Seth. So the idea is there doesn't seem to be any extracurricular intervention from God. He doesn't breathe life into a body. Doesn't say that God breathed life like he did with Adam. It's just they reproduce and produce a person, a whole person, body, soul, spirit, however you want to define that, and yet it's now talking about in his image. Now, that doesn't mean the image of God is gone and it's disappeared, but it's been affected by sin and death, and so now we might talk about it in terms of being corrupted or tainted or infected by this sin and death that causes us to then sin. Probably one of the best explanations in terms of when people are born into this world, even infants can have a bad temper, right? Because we're whole beings affected by sin pervasively. By the way, speaking of kids and parents, I remember when I do premarital counseling with couples, I use this tool called Prepare and Enrich, and as part of the program, it goes back and does a family map. Talks about the closeness and connectedness of parents and how they operated. And when we get into those discussions, we often kind of go, how much do you understand you're like your mom and dad? How much do you understand that you're like your mom or like your dad? Or how does that affect your relationship here? Now, some people sort of give tacit affirmation to that. A lot of people are very aware of the fact that, okay, my dad acted like this. That's the way I am. I get it. I have a hard time overcoming it, but that could really mess up my marriage or my relationships with my kids if I don't learn to deal with this. And so one of the reasons for that is because what Adam passed on to Seth, the good and the ugly, is what gets transferred down. And sometimes it's kind of like a deterioration process. The more you pass it down, the worse it seems to get, depending on which generation you talk to, I guess. But the issue comes back to is that there is a real relationship between Adam and all of us down the road, down that runway, where we're affected by what our parents give to us. Now, if you're talking about a marriage and you don't understand these proclivities you might have, these tendencies and intuitive ways to do it, and you think that the other person's the one that has to change, you can run into a real train wreck. Now, I had one person tell me one time that they go, well, this is just the way I am. And I was really tempted to say, well, that may be, but that's a really stupid comment, especially from a Christian. Because the issue is we don't trust Jesus just so that we can get to heaven. We trust Jesus so that he can change our essential nature so that we are not prisoners to our own bad stuff, and we can rise above it by the power of Jesus and the Spirit of God so that we can learn a new way of life that reflects the person of Christ. Because you and I can't do it on our own. We might be able to manage it. We might be able to cope with it. We might be able to tolerate it. But we can't eradicate this stuff. We can never ultimately conquer our own bad stuff. And so at the heart of this isn't just grand theological theory about how we get affected by Adam. It has real life consequences. And if you're not aware of it, you could create a lot of collateral damage in a lot of people's lives because of the bad stuff that you can blame on your parents, but you're the one living it out. And so it's really critical to get the fact that these were real people, Adam and Eve. They're passing on real consequences and real bad stuff that affects every one of us. We can blame it on everybody else. There's always those people who have a fantastic propensity to blame circumstances, other people. They can blame their parents. They can blame everybody else. But they'll never learn to take responsibility for their own junk. And so they go through their entire life blaming and mad at everyone else. And they're the ones that are their own worst enemies. And that's a lot of what this text is telling us, is that we've got enough stuff in our own life that we can become our own worst enemies. We don't even need to be blaming everybody else for our stuff. It's part of the curse, the reign of sin and death in our lives. But then there's the people that always plead ignorance. Well, this is just the way I grew up and didn't know any better, and this is the way it's supposed to be. And I get that. That can be really painful. But here the text is pretty clear about this, is that there are certain situations, like he says in 13 and 14, Well, for until the law, and he's talking about the Mosaic law, sin was still in the world, but sin was not imputed or counted or reckoned when there is no law. So you hear that and you go, oh, well, maybe ignorance is bliss because, I mean, if I don't know that I'm breaking the law, then who's going to blame me for my bad stuff, right? Verse 14, nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam. So what it's saying is, okay, we didn't do a carbon copy, break the law like Adam did. It was over a tree and some fruit. And we haven't disobeyed God in exactly the same way he did, but the way that you know that we've sinned, even if there's no law, is because death continues to reign. If these people were completely innocent, then the effects of sin, which results in death, would be gone. Well, but wait a minute, if I didn't know there was a law, and I was breaking this stuff, but I didn't know about it, no one said anything to me, how can I be guilty? Well, that's actually, I mean, it's the same question. What about those who never hear the gospel, right? Well, we didn't have the law, so we didn't know what we were doing was wrong. Well, we didn't hear the gospel, so why would God hold us guilty and condemn us if we were ignorant? Well, remember back in chapter 2, we dealt with a section in verses 14 through 16, which talked about those people who didn't have the law. And it's pretty clear from the statement that as you begin to work through this, that when the Gentiles, the non-Jews, those who didn't have the law, by nature do what the law requires, and the question is, how would they know to do that? They are a law unto themselves, even though they didn't have the law. And then here's where the response is. They show the works of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, either conflicting thoughts that accuse them or even excuse them into the process. So what we have talked about in the past is three different kinds of revelation. The two are pretty typical to most people. Natural revelation is how God has created the universe, the trees and the animals. He's got his fingerprints on everything. And God says that is an authentic, genuine sense of revelation that doesn't tell you who God is, but that there is a God and that he is a creative genius in the way that he's put things together. The second one is what we call special revelation, and that is the idea where God deliberately reveals information to us that we wouldn't know about him unless he revealed it. That's how we get our Bible. This is special revelation. He spoke through the prophets, the apostles, and then, of course, Hebrews 1 tells us in these last days he's spoken to us through his Son. God has given us all the information we need to have a right relationship with him and to live a holy and godly life. We don't need to know everything. We've still got to learn to act on what we do know. That becomes the challenge. The danger of having like Groveview classes is people go there for curiosity's sake. I just want to learn more information about stuff. The danger is I can learn all I want. If I'm not doing anything with the truth that I have, it's becoming meaningless. And that's often the picture of our culture. And so as you work through this, there's this intrinsic revelation that I think is created in every person because we're created in the image of God, that God has embedded within that image his law. That's why we have a conscience. And when we do anything, even if there's no law and something bothers us about what someone else does or bothers us about what we do, then that law is kicking in and interacting with our conscience saying, hey, what you're doing isn't right. Now, we can get really creative with it in the sense that we can have a whole bunch of conscience for other people and how they should act, especially towards us, and I can change the rules for me because I think I'm entitled to a different set of rules. But you still, no matter how you paint that, you still have a conscience. And so he's saying here, even if you're ignorant and don't have the actual law that says, okay, well, breaking the speed limit at going 75 miles an hour in a 60 is wrong, and the policeman says, I don't care if you didn't know, that's what's posted, here's the ticket. Right? But especially when it comes down to relationships, if I do things and all of a sudden my conscience starts bothering me, I may not be able to put my finger on it, but something's wrong. And God says, in as far as standing before him, that is perfect evidence for him to say that you couldn't even keep the own law that was written on your own hearts. And so the issue here is, the proof that we're all sinners and affected by sin is physical death. They didn't have a law between Adam and Moses, but there's people that every single person there still died. And that's way of God saying, you want proof that people are sinners? That all this suffering and everything isn't what God did. It's what we brought upon ourselves, and we've inflicted ourselves with this kind of sin and suffering, is that we had the freedom to choose whether we're going to do what God says or not. And when Adam and Eve made that choice, they inflicted us all with the same curse, and so we're victims of it, and we also perpetrate the same problem. We can sit here all day long and compare ourselves to other people, but when we stand before the Lord, we're standing there by ourselves. Well, it was Eve's fault. I don't care about Eve. We're not talking about Eve. We're talking about you, Adam. And God will whittle it down. I mean, you can do it now or you can do it later, but he'll whittle it down so he makes it pretty obvious that I'm making my own choices. I am my own worst enemy when it comes to sin and suffering. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't natural evil and all kinds of things that we don't deserve, but that's the state of our condition. And so death becomes this really measurable essence of the reality of this reign, this imprisonment, this grave that we all live in. And we've already talked about this. Our own brokenness, greed, moral evil, rebellion, lust, selfishness, jealousy, envy, drunkenness, independence, idolatry, broken marriages, dysfunctional families, estranged friendships, exploitation of others. I mean, you can go on and on and on with all the stuff, and I'm pretty sure that if I went on long enough, I could hit something that's been part of your life and been part of my life. And so we're in the grave. The reign of sin and death says we don't have the freedom, the power, the ability, or authority to conquer our own prison. And that brings us back around to the reality of the reign of righteousness, verse 15. That at the heart of this thing, it says simply the first word is but. And what we have to remember is that no matter what our situation, whether we blame other people or we accept it ourselves, the simple fact of the matter is that we all find ourselves under the rule of sin and death, and we're prisoners. But the free gift is not like the transgression. For if by the transgression of the one the many died, much more did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, abound to the many. I might be so bold to say your only hope is Jesus Christ. You might be open to Jesus Christ. You might think he's okay. It's the church you have problems with. You can have every excuse in the world. But the simple fact of the matter, as far as God is concerned, is that the one and only provision he's made for us to be rescued from this grave of reign of sin of death is the person of his son, Jesus Christ. You might be okay with him. You might believe in some of Jesus' teachings. But the Bible says, 1 John 5:11-12, that God has given us eternal life, and this life is in his Son. If you have the Son, you have the life. If you do not have the Son of God, you do not have the life. I mean, that's the whole point of John 3:16. God doesn't hate the world. He didn't send his Son to judge the world. Why? Because the world is already under God's judgment, under his wrath. And I have to plead with you, if you think you can just be good enough, you can sidestep Christ and work harder at coping with your stuff and managing your stuff, and hopefully God will see you as a decent person by the time you get to your end of your life, you're working on a completely wrong set of rules that are completely different than what God has when it comes to evaluating your life. Because the simple fact of the matter is that God's grace is in the person of Jesus Christ. And God's gift is the righteousness of Christ. I mean, it completely exchanges the problem. Adam, sin and death. Christ, righteousness and life. And if you want life that God offers to you, and you begin this journey of not being perfect, but walking along with God saying, I'm willing to learn your values and your priorities and your behaviors that you want me to learn, and I'm going to set my stuff aside, and I want to embrace and learn from you how to live like Christ, we're going to be like every little child, right? When they're young, they haven't got a clue. They just scream, yell, pull temper tantrums, and hit their brother or sister when they take their toys, right? But what does parents do? Well, good parents will discipline and teach kids how to respect and share. God's committed to doing that in our life. We're still bumble around, but God's willing to discipline us to teach us righteousness, how to respect and honor him and to live by faith. God will teach us to do that, but it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, I've got kids that are still learning one or two things, and they're 28 and 26. That's okay. My parents are probably saying, I've got a kid that's still learning a few things, right? Right? Absolutely. Because the moment you think you've got it all put together, you're just like, you're missing the whole point of the journey. And I want to encourage you this morning is to say, there is hope in the midst of our hopelessness. Christ died to end the reign of sin and death. And I want to say most of us are kind of like the Lone Ranger. There's a lot of precious things that we've lost in our life. Sometimes because of what other people have done to us, and sometimes because of very foolish decisions that we've made. And just like God excommunicated Adam and Eve off the primary set of blessing that they had in the garden, he sent his son to reclaim those things that are lost, to put us back into relationship with him. Not so that we can be perfect or we can be arrogant or we can be condescending or judgmental towards others. So just like little kids, we can say, Daddy, teach me what's right and wrong. Teach me the values that I have to live that really honor you. Give me the courage to deny self and my inclinations and my way of doing things and all the bad junk that goes with it. The way I get irritated at people around me, the way I complain because no one does it my way. The way that nobody understands me because they're just all ignorant. And teach me how to live with humility and love and kindness and gentleness and discipline. By the strength of the power of your spirit in me, I want to be teachable. And so for some of you this morning, the issue isn't, well, do you need to trust Christ? But do you need to bow the throne before his throne of grace and surrender your selfishness and your arrogance and your pride and your way of doing things because that's the only right way to do it? And say, Lord, I'm open for you to teach me a new way to live. One that genuinely reflects the person of Christ and the work of your spirit. Because the moment we think we stand, we got to take heed because that's exactly when we fall. You can live under his reign or you can keep living under the reign of sin and death. Choose whom you want to serve. And surrender fully to him. Father, we have to learn humility every single day. Sometimes we think we're God's gift to the people around us. And when the truth is that your son, Jesus Christ, is the gift to every one of us. If we're truly honest and live with humility and we can come into your presence with a sincere faith and a full assurance, a sincere heart and full assurance of faith. Father, for some of us, we simply want to hold fast the confession of our hope because we know we can't do life without him because our brokenness tends to rise up and flare. And we end up feeling separated from you, and we feel separated from the people that we love, and we feel separated when that time of our journey here on earth will take our physical bodies, and our time here will be done. You are the great rescuer. You're the one that can reclaim what is lost. You're the one that can give us hope in the midst of our own hopelessness. Father, thank you for Christ. Because as he said, we have moved from death to life when we believe in the one who sent him and trust in Jesus. Father, help that to be true of every one of us this morning. And if there's someone sitting here that doesn't know Christ, I pray in the quietness even of their own heart that they would simply cry out to you, Lord, I don't understand everything, but I know you love me. And your son died for me. Forgive me and make me a child of God. And I'm willing to learn from you how to live life. For this we pray in Christ's name. Amen.